On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests, in this case, Professor Sandy Tolan. We're at the University of Southern California, where Sandy is a professor of journalism. And it's really exciting to have you here, Sandy, because you are one of the rare journalists that has had the guts to tackle the whole issue of Israel-Palestinian relations. You did it most famously in your book, The Lemon Tree, and now you've come out with a new book, Children of the Stone, which I find just terrific because it's a glimpse at life for ordinary Palestinians. In this case, the story centers around a young kid who was a stone thrower at one point, then became a musician. And in the book, you describe the difficulty of musicians, and you can tell us more about it, trying to travel, trying to play basically classical music for the world. And it's a look at the occupation of Palestine through the eyes and experience of a group of musicians. So why don't you tell us about how you came to write this book and what's the gist of it?
Well, first of all, Bob, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here on your podcast, and thanks for what you said about the book. I was actually working on what was originally the Lemon Tree radio documentary, which aired on Fresh Air back in 1998 on the 50th anniversary of what Israel calls the War of Independence and what Palestinians call the Nakba or the catastrophe. And while I was doing research for what would then later become the book, first the radio documentary, then the book, I kept seeing these signs, posters all around Ramallah, where I was living at the time, doing the research. And it was a picture of this 8-year-old boy throwing a stone in the first Palestinian intifada of the late 1980s. And juxtaposed on the same poster was an 18-year-old young man playing the viola. And it turned out it was the same person, Ramzi Abu Ridwan. And of course, as a journalist, you... This is a story in itself, just these two images on one poster, which was an advertisement for the National Conservatory of Music of Palestine, which had just begun and which, in a sense, represented the hopes of Oslo, of the Oslo Accord, which had been signed a few years earlier. And it was this idea that there's going to be an independent Palestinian state, the so-called two-state solution, two states standing side by side in peace and respectful relations. That was the idea back then. And so Ramzi, whose name ironically means symbol in Arabic, was a kind of symbol of that. So I went to interview him. Turned out he lived in a refugee camp where he had been raised by his impoverished grandparents who had been expelled during the creation of Israel during the Nakba in 1948. But he grew up, you know, as this kid throwing, you know, one of the so-called children of the stones that were throwing stones and trying to expel Israel from the occupied territories by then, at that time, Gaza and the West Bank. And then he grew up and got this opportunity through a relatively well-to-do kind of benefactor and friend, Palestinian, to start learning music. And that's when I met him, just about a year or so after he had begun. He had just gone to a music camp in New Hampshire. He came back all excited with this idea that he wanted to start his own music school. But here's this kid, you know, living in poverty with his grandparents in a Palestinian refugee camp right outside of Ramallah. And when I interviewed him, I did a long piece for NPR at the time in 98. And I said, you know, what's your dream? And he said, well, I want to start my own music schools. And I want to be the first violist for the first National Symphony of Palestine. And I thought, you know, that's a beautiful dream for an 18-year-old kid. But I mean, I didn't really expect that he would do it. And lo and behold, he ended up getting a scholarship to study in France. And I kept in touch with him for a year or two, and I actually visited him in France one time. But then I lost touch, like we often do in journalism. You move on to the next story. And lo and behold, almost 10 years later, literally by chance, I just bumped into him in an Italian restaurant in the West Bank. And I said, "Ramzi, what are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, well, I'm opening up music schools for the children of Palestine," which was precisely what he said he would do when he was an 18-year-old without any resources except for the ones in his head and in his heart. And he said, "Why don't you come by tomorrow and see what we've done?" And little did I know that would sort of change the professional course of my life for the next 5 years.
When I read the book, I thought, wow, this is really an accessible book, because this is not basically a political book. It's a book about people who want to play music and what they have to go through, checkpoints, what they have to do to travel, what they have to do just to lead a normal existence, that reminding us this occupation is a form of national imprisonment of a people. You know, mm-hmm. But you tell it in a kind of soft way of trying to travel with your instrument. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that story and your own view of the reaction to this book?
What I wanted to do was show, in a sense, write a history book in disguise, to engage people with the story of, for example, the girl that's on the cover, Alat, was the first, she's now, I think, 18 years old. She was the first student at age 7 in 2005 when the music school opened. You know, she had grown up under the second intifada, which was much more violent. A lot of suicide bombers, you know, very harsh military retaliations on the part of Ariel Sharon and others. And these children, these Palestinian children, grew up in tremendous fear and trauma, including this girl, Alat. I mean, she lived in what they call old Ramallah Tata, or old Ramallah. And, they had a tank, an Israeli tank, pointing at their house 100 meters away. They saw her older brother snuck out of the house to get bread, to break the curfew so that the family could get bread. And while they were sneaking back, his 14-year-old friend was shot and killed by an Israeli sniper. I mean, these kids, I have a picture of Alat when she was like 3 years old trying to ride her tricycle around with this huge scowl on her face. So what these kids went through was so overpowering. Whoever you believe, whoever you blame, like when it gets down to it, these are kids, these are children. And what I wanted to point out was what it takes to live as a child, in this case, as a Palestinian child, under military occupation. I wanted to try to make the story universal, what it's like to live under a military occupation as a child, what it's like to try to learn music in those kinds of circumstances as a child. And obviously, specifically, it's both universal and it's very specific to this conflict. But I didn't want it to be a polemic. I wanted people to read the story of Alat and of young Ramzi, and then Ramzi growing up and with all his flaws, and he's a very complicated character, a wonderful person, but also, you know, just like every real person in the world, flawed in his own way. But he has done something remarkable. What I wanted to do is make people identify with that. And then if you care about that, then maybe you care about the whole notion of occupation. What has struck me so much, Bob, in covering this story for 20 years is all of the things that have been written, you know, all of the, you know, DVDs that would stretch to the moon and back, all the forests of newsprint, you know, the trees that have fallen in writing the story, so little, and I wouldn't say none because there's some great exceptions, but so little has documented what it's like to live under a military occupation, which in 2017, next year, will turn 50 years old.
I do want to focus on this, and not to make it polemical, but the reason you could ignore the consequence of an occupation is to deny the humanity of the people being occupied. It's mm-hmm. the oldest story in the book. It's the story of Exodus, for that matter, with the Egyptians who acknowledge the humanity of the Jews who are living in Egypt. It's the story that Christ tells in Luke of the Good Samaritan, The Samaritan, does he come to the aid of the other? And right. The test always of any people's morality is how do they treat the other? And the irony of the whole Mideast story for me was I happened to be there at the end of the Six-Day War. Mm-hmm. And by coincidence, my father was from Germany and Protestant, and we had a lot of relatives in Germany. My mother was Jewish. And I find myself at in that region. I was in Egypt. I was in Israel, Jordan. And the whole thing was the language of the Holocaust, the language of we have to be here because never again. And I said, but wait a minute. The Holocaust was not done by Palestinians. It was done by Germans, my relatives, mm-hmm. you know, people I've broken bread with. And mm-hmm. my uncle was actually in the German army. How did the Palestinians get? In fact, the Palestinians had no army. They had not attacked Israel at the time of the Six-Day War. You know, the Egyptians had an army. Israel gets along all right with Egypt, gets along with Saudi Arabia, gets along with somehow the Palestinian people who historically, actually, if you do DNA testing and all that, many of them were the original Jews in the area, or certainly original inhabitants and what have you. And this ability to not only ignore the other, but visit these incredible crimes committed by a totally different people, in this case, Germany and Italy and so forth during World War II, on the Palestinians, yeah. is to my mind, one of the great moral scams of human history. And as somebody who has covered this and has been in the media, how does the media basically go along with endorsing this view?
We in this country grew up with what I call the Leon Uris history, referring to Exodus, the book, the mega bestseller, and then the blockbuster with Paul Newman, which is to say that the way that we write, that most of the media, the uber, so-called uber narrative of American media, is that Israel must be secure. Now, I don't think many people would disagree with that, but that cannot be the only frame for the story. If you look at the so-called Uris narrative, the Exodus narrative, it's the miracle or Israel being born out of the shadows of the Holocaust as a heroic act, end of story. The Palestinians or the Arabs, as they're referred to in that book, are either pathetic, malicious, terrorist, however you define it. They don't have rights. They don't actually have indigenous roots. That's the myth. And the myth was perpetrated in European Zionism in the early to mid 20th century, which people without land go to a land without people, as if there was no one living there. Well, you know, Arabs outnumber Jews by many, and when the immigration increased, it was after Hitler came to power and before, but there was this whole notion that the other, the darker-skinned other by and large, is a threat, is a terrorist, and this became the sort of story that was told. The notion that Palestinians have rights, and that they, as you say, were not to blame for the Holocaust, and yet in a sense, as I believe Edward Said, I can't remember who, have said this, or essentially the victims of the Holocaust. For whatever reason, and, you know, domestic U.S. politics and support of Israel by the Israel lobby, which includes a lot of Christian Zionists as well, and, of course, some people mistakenly refer to a Jewish lobby, which I think is completely inaccurate. First of all, many Jews are progressive. Jewish Voice for Peace, for example, very critical of Israel. But there's this notion that's just been advanced by Israel's attorney general last week, that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. And people are very afraid of being called anti-Semitic. It's a club that's used to silence people.
One of these podcasts that I've done was with somebody who ran AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobby organization, for 14 years, Tom Dine. Mm-hmm. And people can go look up that podcast. And it's interesting because I chatted with Tom Dine about the Labor Party and the earlier Israeli view of the occupation. And when I was there at the end of the Six-Day War, the consensus, I interviewed Moshe Dayan, I interviewed Alon, I interviewed a lot of the leadership at that time. I was in the area and so forth. They recognized that an occupation, a long-lasting occupation, would be the end of the Zionist dream, which is, after all, the idea of people living off the sweat of their own bodies and living normal lives, not exploiting people, not, you know, being occupiers. And, you know, and their idea was that somehow something would be worked out where peace would come out of this. And I was really surprised in this interview with Tom Dine, and one reason I wanted to interview him is he's become a critic of the Netanyahu government. And he feels, and he was very close to Rabin, he was very close to the old Labor Party leadership in Israel, and he feels that the people can listen to the interview, but he was very strong in saying the whole Zionist enterprise, which after all was an idealistic enterprise, has been profoundly subverted by this occupation. And it is interesting that, you know, it took a Bernie Sanders to actually raise this as an issue. It's not much of an issue in the election. It's certainly going to be a big issue going forward, though, in terms of how do you bring peace to the whole region.
Well, we're in a terrible situation now because, you know, I think Israel wanted, Israeli leaders, especially Ariel Sharon and Benjamin Netanyahu, wanted it all. They wanted so-called peace, and yet colonize the West Bank. I mean, again, those numbers, almost 400,000 settlers in the West Bank, not including East Jerusalem, compared to 110,000 at the beginning of the so-called peace process. There are so many settlers now that the idea of there being a two-state solution, unless, you know, you risk some sort of civil war, that's what Shimon Peres has warned years ago. I mean, basically, the two-state solution is essentially over. What you do have is a reality of a one state, which is controlled entirely by Israel and by Israel's military. And in that state, which includes Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza, you have Israeli planes controlling and the air of Gaza and the seas with warships offshore. You have fully 60% of the West Bank under full military occupation by Israel, and with the borders and, you know, checkpoints everywhere in between. You have a reality of a single state, a militarized single state, where some people have rights and some people don't. What is going to have to happen is you cannot have, even John Kerry has warned, Secretary of State Kerry, other Israeli leaders like Ehud Olmert, the former prime minister, have warned, this is going to turn into, and I would submit it has in turn turned into, an apartheid-like or kind of Jim Crow-like state. That cannot go forward indefinitely. There has to be some new thinking based on essential fairness and equal rights. And even Bernie Sanders hasn't moved on from that because he's still clinging to the two-state solution. But I say, how, with all of these settlers all across the West Bank?
What your book does is restore the humanity of these people that have been sidelined in history, the Palestinians. And when I read your latest book, Children of the Stone, that's what came across. Hey, we're talking about human beings, okay? We're talking about human beings, okay?
Thank
we're
you.
Talking about people who want to live, they want to eat, they want to play music, they want to have lives, and it's not working out. Talk a little bit more about the book, because while it's not a polemical message, it's unavoidably important if we're really going to think about the problem. Who are these Palestinians? What do they really want? Is peace possible?
Two stories come to mind, Bob. One is this girl I mentioned before, Ala, when she was, I think, 10 years old, the opportunity arose for her to go to Italy along with a few other people. Her dad became a chaperone, and they all went to Italy to play concerts. Her older brother learned how to play how to build. She went to a special master workshop to build violins. And so there's a whole entourage of Palestinian young musicians affiliated with Ramzi's remarkable music school called Al-Kamanjati, which means violinist. Anyway, they went to Italy, and as they were driving down this road towards Naples, her father was driving a rental car, and Allah turns to her dad and says, "Baba, how come we're not being stopped anywhere? There's no checkpoints." And he said, "Sweetie, Habibti, this is Italy. This is not Palestine." And she thought, and her older brother told me the same thing, that that was the norm, that checkpoints, restrictions, imprisonment essentially was the norm, that that's what they know. One of the things, there's a sort of recurring story that's laced into the book about four musicians, four young men in their 20s, climbing, being smuggled across the wall, the big, what Israel calls the security fence, which is in many cases a 25-foot high wall with barbed wire. Palestinians call it the apartheid wall. Anyway, there's places where you can cross where smugglers, similar to coyotes on the U.S.-Mexico border, smuggle people across. And they climbed up this ladder, and there was a rope ladder on the other side. And they got their instruments with them, a violin, the sticks for the timpani. And they're crossing the wall and slithering down to the other side in order to play a concert at a French church built in Crusader times in the old city of Jerusalem, a Beethoven concert. They risked their lives to play Beethoven in the old city of Jerusalem. They were able to get across because they had been denied entry by Israel, and they joined their fellow musicians on the bus, a bunch of internationals and other Palestinian children. And I was at that concert that night. And let me tell you, when you see what people do just in this case to play music, but also more importantly, to assert their freedom, saying, "Here we are, this is who we are," that's something that will stay with me for the rest of my life.
People listening to this will say, yes, some will say, I recognize their humanity, but these people have not been willing to sit down. There's a whole list of failed opportunities. There's a whole, you know, you can have these right. discussions till you're dizzy. This one did this, and this one did that, and this moment was lost, and that moment was lost. We have a big controversy now. We're both doing this broadcast from the University of Southern California, where there are some people on this campus who would like to support the boycott movement. Mm-hmm. Boycott movement has gotten quite a bit of support, but also enlisted or encouraged a lot of opposition. What is your view of it? Do you think would work?
Well, or so-called BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. This has become a favorite target for, you know, ardent supporters of Israel who do not brook any criticism of Israel. And this includes the aforementioned Haim Saban, who is the Israeli-American and whose wealth comes in large part from the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers franchise, and who has donated, by my estimation, or what I've seen, $6.4 million to Hillary Clinton's campaign. Now, not coincidentally,
And who denies, basically, that there is a Palestinian people?
So here is someone who is the major supporter for Hillary Clinton, and not coincidentally, she is now going after BDS. And she sent this really sort of, I don't know even how to characterize this letter. "Dear Haim, will you help me in supporting the fight against BDS?" Okay, first of all, BDS is a movement to boycott a regime that is holding Palestinians under occupation. One of the targets of the boycott is Caterpillar. Well, Caterpillar is the D9 bulldozer built by Caterpillar has been the subject of controversy. Why? Because they have bulldozed tens of thousands of Palestinian structures in the West Bank. You can go to the Israeli Committee Against Housing Demolition to see more. So it's anti-Semitic to want to boycott Caterpillar? How's that? I mean, again, this whole notion of anti-Semitism, anti-Semitism should be taken very seriously and not be cheapened by conflating it with legitimate criticism of Israel. You know, BDS is also nonviolent. Okay, would I sign up with every single aspect of BDS? Maybe not. But do I believe that they're an effective, nonviolent instrument to bring attention to Israel's illegal occupation of the West Bank? Absolutely.
It seems to me the assumption of the hardline position is if you just keep banging away and enforcing the occupation, it'll go away. And your book is a reminder it will not go away because these are real people. They also have historical memory. They also have family structure. They also have grievances. They also know victims. And that history will endure. And this book is a reminder that we're dealing with a formidable people in the Palestinians. Absolutely. They've been through a lot.
There's been a lot of efforts, you know, by so many people to, even to this day, as you point out, Bob, to say there's no such thing as the Palestinian people. There's never been a place called Palestine. You know, this is just sort of nonsense that's in an effort to actually deny the existence of people who, as you point out quite rightly, Bob, are not going away. There's a Palestinian Arabic an Arabic term called sumud, which means basically steadfastness. And what it translates to in terms of Palestinians is we are here and we're not going anywhere. And of course, there has been a tremendous amount of dispossession. 750,000 Palestinians were dispossessed during the creation of Israel in 1948. Several 200,000 or 300,000 were displaced during the Six-Day War over the border to Jordan and elsewhere. So it's not to say that there hasn't been dispossession. There's been tremendous dispossession. The West Bank itself is 22% of the original Palestine that Palestinians some still dream of. But the fact that these kids are there learning music is just a tiny metaphor, a tiny symbol of what the entire Palestinian population believes, which is we are Palestinian. We do deserve a state. We do deserve to have our own identity recognized.
What's irritating about the boycott movement and similar movements of that kind that have come along to the establishment that wants to give a blank check to Israel, whether it's Hillary Clinton or it's Chaim Saban, is that it's a reminder that the best part of the whole Jewish experience that came out of struggle, came out of survival, came out of oppression, which was human rights, which is reflected in the people that you mentioned in Israel who support these mm-hmm. Palestinian musicians, mm-hmm. that is being subverted. That is being subverted. And what you end up with is a garrison state that does not reflect the values that one had ascribed to Jewish life in the diaspora.
If you're talking about the boycott, I mean, there are many Jews who support the BDS movement, yeah. including prominently Jewish Voice for Peace, which is a very progressive organization. But garrison is the increasing reality on the ground now. I mean, freedom of movement. And I used to play a little game with myself when I traveled to the West Bank. I'd see if I could go an entire minute without some evidence of the occupation, either a settlement on a hilltop, a military patrol, a sign prohibiting entry to a certain, you know, a checkpoint, something. And, you know, in the last couple of times that I've been there, I just gave up playing that little game with myself because you can't go for more than a few seconds, it seems, without seeing some evidence of there being an ever-present military occupation. This has to end. This is the thing that progressives and that, you know, Jew or Gentile, you know, BDS supporter or not, that's what I think the basic thing, the basic next step is, one way or another, the occupation has to end.
What Woody Allen warned about when he was, when he spoke out, I think, quite heroically against the repression of the Palestinians, was that you're hardening the other. You're hardening another mm-hmm. people. And when I was reading your book, I wondered, the great challenge for me was, will the Palestinians be able to preserve their humanity? If you treat people as a prison population, they then take on the mentality of alienation, of a prison population. And the question your book begs is, will they remain a people that want to play Beethoven?
Well, I think the evidence strongly suggests the answer is yes, which is not to say that Palestinian society has not been traumatized. It's been deeply, deeply traumatized by half a century of military occupation. One statistic I've seen is 40% of the adult male population of Palestinians has spent time in an Israeli prison. Is that because they're all criminals? No, obviously not. You know, Israel has something called administrative detention, which is to take people in and not charge them. And then for 30 days they can hold them, and then it's renewable indefinitely. This is a population that has endured so much in terms of human rights violations in particular. Does this trauma affect the future generations? For sure. You know, will it be more damaging the longer it goes on? Yeah. But you go to this day. I mean, you were talking about going there in 67, Bob. I mean, you could go tomorrow and find yourself so welcomed and so embraced. And, you know, your biggest problem, other than sort of dealing with the emotional reality of the checkpoints and the wall and all of that, but other than that, if you spent all this time in the West Bank, say, your biggest problem would be like trying to refuse food. I mean, like the generosity, the so-called Arab hospitality is just rampant, and you'll find yourself really welcomed there. So the answer to your question is yes. I mean, it still endures.
And is this true of your principal character? Why don't we conclude by your telling us how he has survived?
Well, Ramzi Hussein Abu Redwan is an amazing young man. He's in his mid-30s now. He and I we put together a little tour when the book came out last in the summer of 2015, and we're getting one going we're actually looking for some support for help with a national tour in the fall of 2016 and in 2017. It's sort of literary / musical tour where his five-piece ensemble comes, two people based in Europe, a Croatian, a Tunisian oud player, a Palestinian-American jazz singer. It's an incredible musical adventure. And then I kind of set it up by reading from the book, but it's mostly music. He lives with music. He's got music inside him. And I think it's a large reason why his humanity and the humanity of so many hundreds and really thousands of the students that he's exposed music to, why their humanity remains intact.
Well, it's a positive view on which to end. That's it for Sheer Intelligence. My guest has been Professor Sandy Tullin of the University of Southern California, where we recorded this show. The producers are Joshua Shear and Rebecca Mooney. Engineers at KCRW are Mario Diaz and Kat Yore. Check out other editions of our podcast at KCRW and Facebook under Sheer Intelligence. Sacamos.